This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. A bit later in the hour, we call our Sci-Fry book club to order. We're talking about Oliver Sacks' autobiography, On the Move. And if you've been reading On the Move with us, tell us what you think. We'll be taking your calls at 844-724-8255. That's 844-SCI-TALK. So we'll be talking about the book club a little bit later. Want to hear from you. But first, that's the new song from OK Go. It's called Upside Down and Inside Out. You might know the band from their Geeked Out videos. Their videos have featured a Rube Goldberg machine built by NASA scientists and a musical instrument played by a car speeding around a racetrack. Well, they have topped themselves on this one. For their latest video, they took their choreography to an even higher level, 37,000 feet to be exact, and they shot their video in zero G, in other words, while completely weightless. They're here to tell us how and why they decided to shoot a video in a vomit comet. Joining us is Damian Kulash. He is the lead singer. They are all based out of Los Angeles. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thanks for having me. I'm a big fan. This is a big honor.
Well, it's great that it's Mutual Admiration Society. How do you like that? While I was watching the video, I kept asking myself, how did they do that? I mean, how many takes? It looks like it's one long take, but is it?
It is one long take. Here's the thing. It took about 45 minutes to get that one long take. So in parabolic flight, which people like to call the vomit comet, the plane is basically moving in like a sine wave. And so it throws you up in the air and then it catches you. So you're weightless for about 30 seconds at a time. And you've got sort of like what it feels like double gravity right before it while it's throwing you up in the air, and then double gravity right after it while it's catching you. And then there's a period where the plane has to like regain altitude and get reset up for the next round of zero G. So you only get this little period, slightly less than 30 seconds of zero G. So to make one long take, what we did was we would do the first section in the first round of zero gravity. Then when we'd land back in our seats, we'd just stay as perfectly still as we could for the 4 minutes until the next round. We'd pause the music at that point and restart the music when zero G came back, so that we basically did each section sequentially, but with these long periods of sort of waiting in between, that which we later pulled out. You know, we just edited those chunks out, and we had 3+ minutes of pure zero G.
Did the vomit comet live up to its name?
Oh, yes. our crew was like 60-ish people total, but on any given flight, there were usually around 20, 25. Luckily, the band members, we were all on pretty heavy anti-nausea drugs, but some of our crew were like, you know, wanted to go all natural, and boy, did they go all natural. By the end of 21 flights, we had, I think, 58 separate regurgitations.
Yeah, you're qualified now for space, I think, after that many.
We're qualified for part of it. You know, we actually asked. You know, we were working with the cosmonaut trainers at Roscosmos outside of Moscow, and apparently in the 3 weeks that we were doing this pretty much nonstop, we did 2 to 3 times what a training cosmonaut does before they are ready for space. Of course, those cosmonauts are also doing all sorts of, you know, other athletic and science training that we did not do, so I can't just leap into space, but on the zero G part, we have a lot of experience now.
Did you find yourself at all saying during it, whose idea was this?
You're asking the wrong member of the band. I really loved it, and also this is an idea I've wanted to do for like a decade. So, yeah. I mean, basically, back in the mid-aughts, you know, like, do you remember when SpaceX and Virgin Galactic and everything sort of first burst onto the scene, and everybody was like, you know what? Space is now going to have people in it that aren't just like government trained astronauts.
Right.
Like there's other people are going to get up there. And I remember thinking to myself, someone's going to get to make art in space soon. And I was like, I really want to do that. And so, you know, this is an idea we've sort of been chasing since then. And I met with some NASA people, and I met a bunch, you know, I'm just sort of a nerd myself. And whenever I meet a scientist or mathematician who knows about this stuff, I really love to dig into it with them. And This is something we had been chasing for a while. In 2011, we got the opportunity to go on a U.S. commercial flight that does this. You can actually do this for fun. And so I invited my sister, who often co-directs these videos with mm-hmm. me, to join me on that flight. And she and I went on that and did some testing. And we actually were kind of... The first flight we did together, we were like, this is going to be too hard. I mean, it's really hard to control yourself, and there's not a lot to... You need a lot of flights before... We knew we would need a lot of time practicing and playing before we could really come up with something that lasted 3 full minutes and not just like, yeah. Oh, that was cool. You know?
Take us through one of the... I want to take us through a scene. I'm going to play it here, and I want you to describe what's happening here. How did you coordinate all the moves in here? Let me play the scene. Here we go. Wasn't one of them good
enough? Okay, so this one is actually one of the ones where I'm sort of I have to improvise a little bit. Basically, I'm alone at this point, and I have to do a little dance on the ceiling before a pinata comes flying out of the back.
Right.
So I basically my job there was to keep my face to camera as much as I could for the lip sync and to sort of get my moves repeatable. One of the difficult things is to figure out how to, like, once you do something cool, how do you do that a second time? Because it's such a novel environment, you know? At this point now we have we're opening up the overhead bins and the room is filling with disco balls. And then the final scene, of course, is just us popping paint balloons in Zero G, and you just have paint everywhere.
Yeah.
I mean, liquids are like really the liquids are one of the things that really does the best job of describing Zero G, because most things in Zero G actually look like they're just in slow motion. Right. If you think about it, the way your mind knows something is in slow motion is that stuff just hangs in the air. So when stuff really is hanging in the air, your brain goes with the quickest and most, you know, the simplest solution, which is, oh, I must be watching slow-mo. It is a little different with liquids in the sense that, I mean, obviously they do the same thing in slow motion, but when you see us moving at real speed and liquids actually hanging in the air around us, you really get you really know, wow, this is something different.
You know, bands have a reputation sometimes of trashing the stage. You trash this plane. Like I have not seen with all the liquids going around there, splashing around.
So on each flight, we have 15 parabolas, and it takes 8 of those to make a video. So what we would usually do is use the first 7 as practice, and then shoot a full take on the last 8. That last parabola is the only one where we would do the paints. And so when we get back down on the ground, the plane was trashed, our clothes were trashed. We had six copies of our clothes so that we could clean them as many times as necessary. And it meant it, because we were outside of Moscow, it was really cold. This was in October, November, so the plane never actually dried. So you know, we'd get back down on the ground, and people would spray it down with water. But the next day, we'd get in there, and the floor was soaked.
Hmm.
By the way, Tim, our bassist, has just joined me.
Hello, oh, we have about 4 minutes, Tim. Welcome to Science Friday, Tim Nordwind. Tim? Let me ask you right off. Yeah. What's your lasting impression about this video?
Oh my gosh! I mean, it's definitely the most adventurous thing I've ever done. I think I can safely say it's the most adventurous thing the band has ever done. And
you have these circling flight attendants right in the middle of going on there. It's like they seem acrobatic.
I've never seen that before either.
they're actually trained aerialist acrobats.
Yeah.
And we chose them because when we were trying to figure out who would be able to do really cool moves in this environment, we thought of synchronized swimmers, we thought of gymnasts. But one thing was that we knew these people would have amazing vestibular systems. Like, most of us get dizzy after we spin around twice. Their job is to spin around on a hoop or on fabric
right.
strands. And so they spin like the head of a power drill, and they're just fine, you know? And another thing is that they have to learn how to control their movements mostly with their own strength and by sort of reacting against inertia as opposed to pushing against, like, a swimmer pushes against water, a gymnast pushes against the floor. But you know, when you're in weightlessness, you really can't control your movements at all. You push something and then you're sailing until you hit something else.
Yeah, those dancers, they had no fear. I mean, they just went right for it. I mean, on the first flight, when I was like holding on to everything I could, basically, they were all, like, the very first parabola, they were doing circles and flipping and spinning around. It was amazing to watch.
We talked to astronaut Scott Kelly. He was aboard the space station for a year. Any interest after making this video of spending some time up there?
I would love that. I would love that.
Sure.
Yeah. Well, so how do you top this? I mean, how can you top this on your next video? Are you thinking about that already? When you were parabolas up there, were you thinking, how are we going to top this while you were still doing it?
No, I mean, we're always chasing new ideas. The thing is, like, everyone's sort of assumption is that we're trying to top the last video or the last song or the last tour with something specifically designed to one-up it. It's not really like that. We love chasing our creative ideas, and there is a tendency towards this mission creep. You know, it's like once you've done something that stops being like a challenge or stops being thrilling. And so, I mean, it is really hard to think of what could possibly be a bigger logistical challenge, a bigger artistic challenge than this situation. But, you know,
we may never feel thrill again.
Well, Tim,
that's not true.
Tim, I'm kidding.
Tim, you're part of a hack and roll course at the Royal College of Art. What is that about? What's the collaboration there?
Oh, that's actually Damien. That's...
Yeah, I was working with a friend of mine, Yuri Suzuki, who's a designer in London. He teaches at the Royal College of London, and we did a course where the students were what they were set out to do was hack synthesizers to make new art projects out of them. So I went and taught with him for a couple of days, and it's really the students did some amazing, amazing work.
All right, we've run out of time, but this is a great video. We're talking with Damien Kulash and Tim Nordwin, the bassist for OK Go. They're based out of Los Angeles, and it's the new video is Upside Down, Inside Out. Thank you, gentlemen, for a bit taking
time to be
with
us.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
And we have the video. You can watch OK Go's video on our website at sciencefriday.com/OKGo. Coming up, it's our Sci-Fi Book Club is in session. We're going to be talking about Oliver Sacks' autobiography, On the Move. If you'd like to talk with us, please phone in now before it gets to be too crowded. 844-724-8255, 844-SCI-TALK, with our book club right after this break. We'll be right back. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Oliver Sacks made his name as a writer and neurologist by bringing readers into the lives of his patients. There was Rose R. of his book Awakenings, frozen by sleeping sickness at the age of 21, and then suddenly awakened at 64. There was the lost mariner Jimmy G., memoryless and stuck in 1945. And who could forget Dr. P., the man who mistook his wife for a hat? But in his 2015 book, On the Move, Oliver told a different story, this time his own. And for the past 3 weeks, the Sci-Fi Book Club has been reading Dr. Sacks' autobiography, On the Move. We've ridden cross-country with him on his beloved BMW bike. We swam with him in the jellyfish-infested waters around New York's City Island. And now we're back in the studio to talk about On the Move. And if you've been reading along with us, give us a call. Tell us your favorite On the Move story. Our number, 844-724-8255, 844-SCI-TALK, or if you want to do it online, you can tweet us at SciFry, SCIFRI. Let me reintroduce our book club guests here. Danielle Ofri is a physician at Bellevue Hospital and an associate professor of medicine at NYU's School of Medicine. She's editor-in-chief of the Bellevue Literary Review and author of books including What Doctors Feel. Welcome, Dr. Ofri. Good to see you again. Maria Popova is the editor and founder of BrainPickings.org. Welcome back, Maria.
Always fun.
And sci-fi producer Annie Minoff, the chief of the book club, is back. Hi, Annie.
Oh, well, thank you.
Let me start with you. And tell us, for book club newbies, give us a little synopsis on the move, what the book is about.
Well, that's quite a task because
it's a
book,
giant book.
That covers Oliver Sacks' life from about age 18 to 80. So I'll just zero in on a few different strands here. I think one of the most important stories that this book tells is the coming out story. You know, as Maria has actually written on Brain Pickings, this is the story of a young gay man in the 1960s looking for love. And it's sometimes a very heartbreaking story, sometimes very joyous. I think there's elements of travelogue in this book as well. So you mentioned, you know, the cross-country motorcycle rides on the back of his beloved BMW R60. I would actually lump the drug trips in there as well, these kind of terrifying voyages of the mind that he writes about. Mm-hmm. So it's a story of drug addiction and recovery. It's also the story, I think, of a young doctor and a writer really kind of discovering himself in the clinic and discovering himself in interactions with patients and in telling their stories.
Mm-hmm. And Maria, you've called this one of the most profound reading experiences of your life. What hit you so hard about this book?
The completeness of it. It's such a beautiful record of a really unusual and extraordinary human being coming to terms with his wholeness.
Hmm. And it goes through the whole book that way? I mean, it goes through so many parts of his life, right?
And you can begin to see how they inform one another, how they're in constant dialogue with one another over time and in very kind of intimate and imperceptible ways that actually inform what he's known for, his medicine, his writing, his whole personhood.
But it's also the physical part that no one knew about, really, really realized, isn't
yeah.
it? Yeah. Danielle, what was your first impression of the book?
Well, most of us know Dr. Sacks as an avuncular, elder statesman of a physician and writer. So to see him in this full three dimensions of his sexuality, his drug use, his weightlifting, motorcycle use, the three dimensions of his family, all parts that we didn't really know about.
Yeah.
And I was particularly taken by how hard it was for him to find his niche in the world, whereas most of us knew him as having created and capitalized and been this sort of patron saint of the niche of the doctor writer. In fact, it took him a long time to carve that out.
But wherever he went in those niches, he was outstanding. And those little niches.
And yet people didn't realize that for a long time.
And nor did he. I think he felt himself bumbling about, kind of befuddled as he went through these and didn't realize that he was creating these niches.
Mm-hmm. But the interesting thing is that the niches came together. There were like puzzle pieces
yes.
that he finally mm-hmm. was able to put together into the complete picture of what he stood for and who he was.
But mm-hmm. I think he didn't plan it that way. And that for me was one inspiring takeaway message, that he didn't plan the life to become the neurologist, the itinerant doctor, writer, but he came upon these, and I think it gives us a lot of hope about the role of serendipity in our lives.
Interesting. Our phone number, if you'd like to join us in our discussion of Oliver Sacks' book, On the Move, our phone number, 844-724-8255, 844-724-8255, or you could do the 844-SciTalk part. Annie, you spoke with Oliver's longtime collaborator, Kate Edgar, about why he finally sat down to write On the Move. Like, he was in his 80s,
That's right. And it's worth noting that this is actually Oliver Sacks' second autobiography. So he came out with the book Uncle Tungsten in 2001, and that covered, you know, his childhood up to about age 14. But according to Kate, you know, who's been Oliver's sounding board and editor for more than 30 years, he always said that there wasn't going to be a part two, that frankly, he wasn't really interested in revisiting, you know, his 20s, his 30s. And then he turned 80.
At the age of 80, I think he felt that it was time to just come clean with his whole story. And I think he also realized that if he didn't write his autobiography, someone else would write a biography of him. And he wanted to just set the record straight.
Which he does in this book. But another question that I had for Kate is, you know, something that really struck me about On the Move is how intensely personal it is. And you almost feel like he's forgetting that you're reading.
Yeah, that's true.
And she said that, in fact, a lot of kind of the very personal sections of the book where he's talking, for example, about his sexuality or even kind of tense situations with his medical bosses, that he really wrote those for himself and didn't even think that he might publish them. And it really took, you know, writing them and seeing how they all came together as a whole that really started to change his thinking.
Once he could look at the book as a whole with all of these parts in it, he felt that it had an integrity, and he felt much bolder about putting himself out there to the world. That was very, very important for him to be accepted not only for the brilliant physician and writer he was, but as a whole person.
Right. And I think that's what Maria was touching on in terms of the completeness. Like, we do get the whole person in this book.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to the phones. We have some phone calls coming in, 844-724-8255. Let's go to Jacksonville, Florida. Peter, hi. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, thank you. I was interested in his comments about the way his papers were received in The Lancet and in JAMA. He seemed to think that his papers were received very favorably in The Lancet based on the feedback that he received, but he said that he received almost no feedback from the papers he published in JAMA.
Danielle, any comment on that?
Well, I wonder if it was the different background of American versus British physicians. And if you look at The Lancet even today, it's much more widely inclusive of other kinds of writings, artistic, creative, political writings, whereas American journals are much more straight-laced and I think came much later to the game in terms of medical humanities and medical humanism.
Let's go to another call. Let's go to Kathleen. And is it Chagrin Falls, Ohio?
It is.
Go ahead. Well, join us.
Thank you. As I read this book, I thought I was reading the story of one of the kindest people who must ever have lived. I think he made decisions based on what would bring more love into the world and never less.
Maria Popova is shaking her head up and down, agreeing with you wildly.
Yes, and actually one of the loveliest stories from the book is a moment in which he chooses compassion and kindness over vengeance. Should we tell the story?
Yeah.
So it's in the 60s, in his motorcycle days, and his telling the story of how motorcyclists were kind of, there was a bias against them, and drivers would sometimes intimidate them to a point of threatening their lives. And sure enough, that happened to him on two occasions. The first one, he caught up with the driver, poked his hand through the window, got the guy's nose, and twisted it. And he kind of felt gratified, and he felt that it was commensurate with the guy having almost killed him. Shortly thereafter, he's on the freeway, and another car tries to run him off the road, and he catches up to the car and kind of chases it down this little little town, and the car gets stuck in a cul-de-sac, and so he gets out of the motorcycle waving a monopod, because this was in his photography days too, and looking like this crazed Don Quixote on a, you know, horse. And he comes up to the window and he looks inside and he sees four terrified teenagers, two couples, and he drops the monopod and shrugs his shoulders and walks away. And it's this moment in which you get the sense of his extraordinary ability to see inside another mind and anticipate another experience on top of his own humanity of having been so enraged. He chose love and kindness.
And that's the empathy he brought to his patients that we learn about, how he could get inside them as opposed to staying aloof from them. Danielle, do you have a favorite story?
Well, along those lines, one of my many favorite stories is when he, in his motorcycle days as a resident in California, one of his patients who's dying, paralyzed and blind, just wants to be out at the sunrise. And so he gets his motorcycle buddies, and they take this paralyzed woman onto his motorcycle, strap her to him and to the motorcycle, and he takes off and drives her overnight to see the sunrise, I think, at the Grand Canyon. And of course, when he comes back, he's, you know, broken all protocol and he gets yelled at, but he gave the patient the gift of what she really wanted to be. To take care of someone is different than curing them or giving medical care. And I think he saw the expansiveness of that and his empathy and recognition of what being human is.
Annie?
But he also takes himself, I think, to task when, you know, for those failures of kindness. So he writes a lot about his brother Michael, who suffers from schizophrenia. And he talks about, you know, sometimes when he was living at home with Michael, just wanting to get out, wanting to escape. And he talks about, you know, how might things have been different if I just offered, you know, hey, Michael, let's go see a movie or let's go to a concert, things that, you know, his brother might not have done on his own volition. And you can hear just kind of the pain in his writing for these, you know, something he failed to do 60 years ago. Mm-hmm. And I was really struck by that.
Let's go to Gypsy in Oklahoma City. Hi, welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, thank you for having me talk. My point was that in reading the book, I was struck by how successful his mother and father and some of his brothers were and how that seemed to make him feel less than sometimes. And so I thought it was touching how it seemed to make him question his own success so many times.
Yeah. Did you get that impression too? Mm-hmm.
I mean, I wondered if that was one of the reasons he didn't want to write his autobiography. I felt that he seemed shy, but also that he didn't feel like he did that much, that there wasn't enough to really write about. And I think only the convincing of others around him that his accomplishments were that significant mm-hmm. made him finally decide to write. Mm-hmm.
Gypsy, did you have any trouble reading? Was it a page turner for you? Or did you put it down, pick it up?
Well, there were parts that seemed a little bit too obsessive, too much into his own writing. But then there were other parts that were just, it was like a page turner, like you say.
Mm-hmm. All right. Thanks for calling. Yeah, it is the kind of book that you could put down for a while, pick it up, and pick up his story because it does flow just like his life did, you know. Very personally written. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from PRI Public Radio International. If you're just joining us, we're in our book club. It has convened. Our number, 844-724-8255, with Dan Yalofrey, Maria Popova, Annie Minoff, talking about Oliver Sacks' autobiography, On the Move. Let's talk a little bit more about the book. I know, Maria, that you did some bodybuilding in college. And, you know, there's that part that none of us knew about in Oliver's life, what a bodybuilder he was. And he holds the California record for, 600, lifting 600 pounds?
Squatting.
But, Let's see how much difference I know.
Say that bodybuilding and weightlifting are entirely different sports.
He was a weightlifter, yeah.
But both of these sports require a tremendous discipline. Driven by an almost scientific obsessiveness. You have to be pretty cognizant of and knowledgeable about anatomy to train well. You have to be knowledgeable about nutrition down to a biochemical level to feed yourself. And I think that obsessiveness and that discipline stays with you even after you're done competing. With Dr. Sacks, certainly in his writing, you can see the same kind of purposefulness and drivenness.
Mm-hmm. And that's what our caller, we have a caller, Matthew from Cincinnati on the phone. Hi, welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, thanks for letting me call in. It's a really great honor to be speaking, and especially on the subject of Oliver Sacks and this book. I just wanted to make a quick comment about his interdisciplinary nature.
Yes.
I think it's undervalued in the sciences and humanities. And it's really what kind of pulled me into what I do now. I studied kind of in a broad range of fields, and that was partly because someone had thrown an Oliver Sacks book at me when I was in my early 20s.
No kidding. Wow.
Well, it's wonderful, actually. I recently went through the many books that he mentions in his book, the books that influenced him and his life, and it really is so eclectic. He loves poetry and philosophy and a lot of science, a lot of travelogues from early explorers, and you can begin to see how this cross-disciplinary mind fed itself.
Yeah.
The one thing I noticed is that he gave himself a relative freedom from institutional medicine, academia, and most people in academia now are very narrowly focused because you have to be. You have to publish, you have to write in that area and get grants. But I think that Dr. Sacks, and maybe it wasn't intentional, but by freeing himself of this, was able to cross disciplines without getting much flack.
Mm-hmm. I want to follow up a little bit on that because, Danielle, one of the things I started to wonder as I read the book was, how would Oliver Sacks do as a young doctor today if he was, say, 30? You know, how would he find the medical profession?
I don't think, I can't imagine how he would survive today. I mean, most physicians, all of us, need to see a certain number of patients to keep the economics of our practice or hospital afloat. And to sit and wax poetic for an hour on one case, it's a luxury that we don't have now. In the places you do find it, I think that medical students are still in the realm where they can do that. And maybe as a student, he might have found, you know, his spot. But it'll be very hard in practice to be able to have that freedom of academic thought.
Yeah, we're going to take a break. It's a good point. And come back more and talk lots more about Oliver Sacks with Maria Popova, Dan Yalofrey, and our SciArts producer, Annie Minhoff. So stay with us. We'll be right back after the break. Our number, if you'd like to get in on the book club, absolutely, 844-724-8255. You can also tweet us at SciFry. We'll be watching for your tweets. Stay with us. We'll be right back after this break. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking this hour about Oliver Sacks' autobiography, On the Move. It's our Sci-Fry Book Club, and with me in the studio are Maria Popova, editor of BrainPickings.org, Danielle Ofri, author and physician at Bellevue Hospital here in New York, editor of the Bellevue Literary Review, and Sci-Fry SciArts producer Annie Minhoff. Our number, 844-724-8255.
I just wanted to jump in because I have a question for Maria, which is, you know, I mentioned Oliver began writing the book at 80, and I just wondered, you know, is that significant? Would it have been a different book had he written it, say, you know, middle age?
Mm. Well, I think 80 is definitely some kind of singular precipice because Henry Miller wrote a book called On Turning 80, lovely little book, and the poet Donald Hall just released Essays After 80.
So there's something.
Yes. But generally speaking, I think as we age, the gap between our private self and our public persona begins to narrow. When we expend less energy on kind of people pleasing and pretzeling ourselves into who we'd like to be perceived as. And I think, you know, we spend the vast majority of our lives building our personal mythologies, these hopeful fictions of who we'd like to be, and the very last bit owning our truths. And that's what he did so beautifully that I don't think he could have done if he was busy
people-pleasing
and, you know, all of that. Yeah, mm-hmm.
I saw it a little differently. I thought about the presence of illness as what gave him the window and impetus. And perhaps if he had been ill at 40, that might have been the time, because illness gives us the, you know, earth-shattering sense of our vulnerability, and the gap between who we think we are as physical bodies and who our bodies actually are narrows and or widens, I should say, and maybe that sense of my body's now doing things differently than I had hoped it would do perhaps gave him the impetus to start digging inward.
But he came so close to death on so many occasions, which is one of the most extraordinary things about the book, that you think perhaps he would have been aware of his destructibility more so than the average person.
Though many of those were very acute, episodic,
and
brushes
accidents.
With death, and accidents.
You know.
This was the, you know, the decline where he could see what was happening. And I remember one of his last letters he wrote to me, he talked about, you know, having a lot of fluid buildup, you know, from the liver disease, and knowing that I knew what that portended, and that he knew what that portended, that that his end was in sight, and I suspected or projected that that's what gave him the impetus to really start opening himself up.
Mm. And yet he was in great. I saw him a few months before his death. He was in great spirits, and he even said, "You know, I have a couple of more books in me." And Kate talked about this a little when we had our meeting at the Botanical Garden for our book club members earlier last week. And she said that she has papers of his.
Oh, yeah.
That there's going to be a book or two more coming.
Yeah, and I should put a plug for the Oliver Sacks Foundation, which was launched to do that. There's like a foundation now dedicated to doing that.
Hmm. Do you have a favorite part?
Okay. A favorite On the Move story. I do, and it comes from a little later in the book, so no motorcycles, but Oliver is taking a walk, a nighttime walk through his neighborhood in Greenwich Village, and because he's Oliver Sacks, of course, he has a little pocket spectroscope with him. So he's looking through this device, and what this does is you point it at a light source, and it'll kind of break up the light into its various spectral lines. So, for example, you point this at neon, and you'll see this, you know, beautiful red streak. Mm-hmm. And so he's walking down the street, peering at different light sources, and then he passes by a gay bar, and he starts, you know, looking through the window at all the neon inside, and slowly starts to realize that the patrons at the bar are like a little perturbed by this older dude looking at them through the window through this like little instrument. And so what does he do? He strides into the bar, and he declares, and I quote, "Stop talking about sex, everyone. Have a look at something really interesting." And, you know, he passes around the spectroscope, and everyone's, you know, ooh, ah. But why I love that story is it just shows, you know, this is a guy who, by his own account, was very shy and kind of didn't chat easily with other people. But when it came to science, everyone was his friend. You know, he brought people in with his enthusiasm, you know, as he did that night at the bar, but also in every book he ever wrote. So that's why I love that story.
Yeah, one of my favorite stories is the time he decided to swim. He swam everywhere around New York, and with the jellyfish in the water, no matter what, and he swam around City Island, and he goes out of the water. He sees a house he likes. He says, he goes up and knocks on the door and says,
Dripping wet.
I want to buy this place. You know? And it sings to me because over 30 years ago, I learned to sail at City Island, and New Yorkers don't even know that City Island is part of New York. So, yeah, he was the first person I met who actually, and he was living there, actually was living on City Island and knew it was part of New York City. So it was kind of sung to me there. Mm-hmm. But there's so many stories. Let's see if we can take a couple of phone calls in before we have to go. Let's go to Williamsburg, Iowa. Terry, are you there?
I am.
Hi there. Welcome.
That was a great book. My question is, Dr. Sacks wrote a great deal. He wrote letters, journals, manuscripts. I know you said that there were going to be a couple of books that will be coming out, but what is going to happen to the remainder of those, you know, photos, things like that?
It's a good question. Maybe the foundation, the Oliver Sacks.
Yeah, that might be a question.
Yeah, Kate Edgar is working on two books forthcoming, and who knows what else they're going to find in his enormous archive.
Yeah, because, see, thanks for calling, because we know from the video that we did, the desktop diary of his, that he loved tchotchkes. He loved little desktop things and toys that he played with. So there's a lot of stuff still that might be showing up. People might be able to look at it. Maybe it'll be a little exhibit of his someplace. Do we have as we come toward the end of this book club, do we have any conclusions about the book? I mean, something that's... Life lessons learned about how to live? Did it make you think about living your life any differently?
It did. I noticed that Oliver Sacks saw the drama in small things, that the smallest change in a patient's behavior, the idea that every patient was extraordinary, even if the disease was known and understood, the patient themselves, each one, was different and extraordinary, and that the smallest fern or snail or coin on the street was its own drama, and that to stop and notice. And for me, you know, I get so, you know, overwhelmed and busy with minutiae, the idea of taking the time to take the spectroscope and to look at the light and tune out everything else for the moment is a lesson from Oliver Sacks.
And related to that, and related to Annie's favorite story, science was his social lubricant because he felt a sense of competence in it, and competence always grants confidence. And science was also the part of his identity that was always rewarded as opposed to punished since he was a child. He had no self-consciousness around it. He had no guilt, only this radiant enthusiasm. And I think anything we deliver in the language of enthusiasm enlarges our experience, enlarges other people's experience.
Anything for you?
I would take away just his strong self-concept. I mean, this is a man, his first book, Migraine, he wrote based on the experience of patients in a migraine clinic. His boss at the time let him know in no uncertain terms that if he published this book, it would be the end of his medical career in the United States for convoluted reasons we won't get into. But he goes ahead and publishes it because he knows it's the right thing to do, and he stands by it. And I think, you know, a lesser writer, a lesser person would have, you know, not done that. So I think it's a lesson to us all to, you know, listen to ourselves more.
I think for me it's also that just the title On the Move shows that life has a lot of different directions you go in, and you never know. Well, he never knew where that next turn, literally on his motorcycle, was going
to
take
him. He was open to serendipity. Yes. I think many of us are not.
Yeah, and he took those turns and went with them, you know, and made the best out of them. And that's what we all would hope he'd be able to do.
Yeah.
Well,
good book.
Yeah, it's great.
Fantastic.
It's a great book. And you can catch up on the book club. You can read an excerpt from On the Move and listen to an Oliver Sacks playlist. That's at sciencefriday.com/bookclub. We'll be deciding, Annie, on another book pretty soon.
Come July.
Come July.
Stay tuned.
Annie Minhoff is our SciArts producer and in charge of the book club. Also, thank you to Danielle Ofri, author and physician at Bellevue Hospital here in New York, editor of the Bellevue Literary Review, where the doctors write the articles.
Actually, all kinds of people write, it's about health and healing.
There you go. And Maria Popova, editor of BrainPickings.org. Always good to see you, too.
Always a pleasure.
Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Time now for a segment we call The Macroscope. Last week, Science Friday video producer Luke Raskin strolled to Times Square to ask tourists from all over the world one simple question.
Okay, now look at those two images and tell us which of those is Booba and which of those is Kiki.
He had a piece of paper with him, and on that piece of paper were two shapes. One was what you might call a blob with rounded edges. The other was all sharp angles. Think of a starfish with lots of pointy arms. Luke's question for those Times Square tourists was which of these shapes should be called Booba and which one should be called Kiki. The answer is the subject of our latest macroscope video, and Luke joins us now to talk about it. Welcome, Luke.
Hi, Ira.
How was it out there in Times Square with those folks?
Well, it was cold and it was really fun and also a little random at times.
Why were you harassing those poor tourists?
Well, we wanted to simulate some of the research that's been done looking at why people associate some shapes with sounds. It sounds like a random question with silly nonsense words, but actually this has been researched since the 1920s, this very concept of taking a sound and a shape and asking people which match one to the other.
So the two sounds were Booba and Kiki.
Booba and Kiki, that's right.
And you showed them photographs.
That's right, that's right. And luckily enough for us, their answers actually mirrored the research itself. 90% said the round one was Booba and the pointy one was Kiki. Thank goodness.
And that was true no matter where the person was from.
Yeah.
Because there are a lot of tourists.
Yeah. It's all tourists.
It's a great spot to try something out about the world there.
Exactly. So we spoke to people from Finland, from Germany, from Singapore, from China, people that didn't, their first language was not English. And we didn't show them the spelling of these words. I'm not going to tell you them. But the studies, you don't want to show them the spelling because that could influence the typography,
right?
Is round or pointy. So we didn't show them the spelling. And that stands up in the research as well. And in fact, the researchers have actually done this with toddlers, kids that don't know how to spell. And the Booba Kiki effect holds up.
And of course, if people don't actually have those sounds in their vocabulary, they can't read them, even if they're written, if they have a different kind of language.
Exactly, exactly. And what was really fascinating was to hear how people could explain this phenomenon. We got a lot of really crazy answers.
This is more softer, so this must be Booba.
Booba sounds like bubble.
Booba to me, maybe a splash, Kiki, I don't know, maybe something shiny like a key ring, just something rhymey.
I think this is Booba. It looks like the Nickelodeon splat, the old splat. That's what it reminds me of, but I think this might be Booba. I don't know.
Yeah, it's talking about Booba and Kiki with Luke Raskin on Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. And it does look like a little bit like that Nickelodeon logo from a while back.
It does. I mean, it's fascinating to hear a woman say it's softer. Softer. I mean, it's just a shape. I mean, I don't see how you get Booba softer. It's fascinating.
But the researchers must have some idea of why this happened.
The researcher that we spoke to, Kelly McCormick of Emory University, gave us three different theories. The first is one that we're all a little bit synesthetic with this notion of that we tie, an image or visuals to a sound, or we hear something and we think of the color green, or we smell something and we immediately think of a concept, or vice versa. And so that's one theory. There's another theory that this is an experiential thing, that we've learned to make these associations. So if I take a bowling ball and I roll it on the ground, it's going to make a whoa, whoa, whoa. And that sound, roundness equals a more rounded sound, and so we should call it Booba. And then vice versa, if you take a pine cone and you roll that, you're going to get a more poppy, crackly noise. The third one is that your mouth makes a certain shape. And when you're making these sounds, so when you say booba, it's very round, your eyes, everything gets open. And so we should name it something. So we should associate those things. And Kiki is a little bit more, your face becomes more taut, your eyes become taut. It's more tense. So we should call it something a little bit more tense.
So they don't know which one is the right one. But well, those are three possibilities.
Well, a lot of people think it's a hybrid of all these different kind of theories. And, you know, there's no right or wrong answer here. But they have done research where they looked at 570 different nonsense words, trying to narrow in on which one was the most pointed and which one was the most round. And so that's the longest list of nonsense words I've ever seen. And they narrowed it down to the top three for pointedness was kite and kite and tite were the most pointed. And for rounded, it was lumo and mumo, which are very, those sound very round. And if you look at the waveforms on those, the actual, you know, when they run them through a machine and you actually look at what those look like, they're very round and very pointed. So it makes perfect sense.
What if I wanted to call the pointy one Tic Tacs?
That's totally
that would work.
Yeah, that sounds like tite, doesn't it?
Yeah.
That totally works as a pointed word.
What surprises me is that they went all around the world to even cultures that don't they said these things to them, cultures that had never heard the word or even those kinds of sounds, right? And they all 90% all agreed.
Upwards of 90%. You know, when they went and spoke to Bush people in Africa, they, you know, that don't have the Roman English alphabet, they found out it was roughly like 75%. But, you know, they brought it to Tamil speakers in India as well, and they found that it matched identically the results when they spoke to undergraduates at UC San Diego.
Wow, it's great video. You can watch the video and you can see for yourself what a booba and what a kiki look like. It's up on our video at sciencefriday.com. And while you're there, we use our voices to tell others how we feel. No surprise there, but can your voice influence how you feel? We've got the answer at sciencefriday.com/voice. Luke, great to have you back.
Thanks, Ira.
Luke Raskin of Science Friday's video producer. Are you a booba or a kiki? And what the heck are we talking about up there on our website at sciencefriday.com? BJ Lederman composed our theme music. Our thanks to our production partners at the studios of the City University of New York. And remember, when we did our website back in October, we all had hard work. Well, it's paying off because sciencefriday.com has been nominated for a Pixel Award. You can show your support by voting for us at scifry.me/pixelawards. Right now, Soul City is beating us. Come on, folks, we're better than that. Cast your vote at scifry.me/pixelawards, and we will thank you for it. Have a great week, and happy Valentine's Day. Up on our website, we have special Valentine's, kinds you probably not see anywhere science-related. Go to our website at sciencefriday.com. Have a great weekend. Happy Valentine's Day. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.